of journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free of all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Friday, June 29th, 2012, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think.
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 Silence is not an option.
What the Supreme Court's decision to uphold the Affordable Care Act means, a look at Mexico ahead of highly anticipated elections, and activists gear up for massive invasion of Walmart stores in L.A., plus this week's Rethink Reviews.
But I can't help myself. Why should I?
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. In a momentous decision taken by the United States Supreme Court, 5 out of 9 justices voted to uphold President Obama's signature health care law, the Affordable Care Act. Activists on both sides of the political spectrum have waited for months for the decision, which, coming in an election year, has potential ramifications in November. In initial assessments, the press, including CNN and NPR, erroneously announced that the individual mandate aspect of the ACA was found to be unconstitutional. However, closer reading of the decision found that the nation's highest court has indeed upheld all aspects of the law. Conservative Chief Justice John Roberts, who was a swing vote in joining the liberal justices, writing for the majority opinion, said, quote, "The Affordable Care Act's requirement that certain individuals pay a financial penalty for not obtaining health insurance may reasonably be characterized as a tax. Because the Constitution permits such a tax, it is not our role to forbid it or to pass upon its wisdom or fairness." Another provision of the ACA that requires states to expand their Medicaid rolls for poor Americans was also essentially upheld. While the court asserted that Congress overstepped its constitutional authority in that provision, it said the federal government cannot withhold existing Medicaid funds to states who fail to expand the program. Also upheld yesterday was the Affordable Care Act's banning of the practice among many private insurance companies of charging women more for insurance than men simply because they're women. President Obama, in responding to the decision, said, quote, "Today's decision was a victory for people all over this country whose life will be more secure because of this law and the Supreme Court's decision to uphold it." The presumptive Republican nominee Mitt Romney commented, "This is a time of choice for the American people. If we're going to get rid of, quote, Obamacare, we're going to have to replace President Obama. My mission is to make sure we do exactly that." My guest is Richard Kirsch, author of Fighting for Our Health, The Epic Battle to Make Healthcare a Right in the United States. He's the national campaign manager of the Healthcare for America Now Coalition. Welcome to Uprising, Richard.
Good morning. How are you doing this morning?
Doing very well. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, how do you respond to what happened yesterday? Were you surprised the right was getting ready to, and it seemed as though people were anticipating that the ACA would be deemed unconstitutional, at least the individual mandate aspect of it?
Yes, I was prepared for the court to overturn the individual mandate. In fact, when CNN first reported it, I was holding my breath to see if they'd take the next step and also overturn the ban on insurance companies turning people down for pre-existing conditions. But it was a thrill to see that the court had actually upheld the law. It's interesting decision because most constitutional scholars feel like the individual mandate was constitutional under the Commerce Clause, but the 5 conservative justices ruled against that. But then what Chief Justice Roberts turned around and said, but this clearly is a tax, and it is. It's collected through the IRS, and so that keeps it within constitutionality. So there may be some other implications of this for other things down the line in terms of Congress's ability to regulate commerce. But for the immediate and really historic accomplishment of, for the first time, we have a government guarantee of affordable health care for most people in the country, it's a huge victory, and it's a huge victory that will save tens of thousands of lives every year.
How will the government guarantee that health care will be affordable? Because for those people who have insurance now, even if they do have insurance, I wouldn't characterize it as being exactly affordable unless you happen to be quite wealthy.
Well, you know, it's affordable, much more affordable than not having any insurance at all. It depends on your income, how affordable it is. Yes, people are paying more than they should have out of their paychecks for health care. And yes, out-of-pocket costs are higher than we'd most like them to be. But still, it's still people pay a small percentage of their income for health care. And when you compare that to people who don't have health insurance now, who tens of thousands of people die every year because of that, many more don't get the health care they need because of the financial barriers to health, this law will change that for some 16 million people. Maybe not quite that much because of the one part of the court decision, will get Medicaid for the first time, which does not have any financial barriers to care. And for many other working class and middle class people, they'll be able to get health insurance for the first time without worrying about bans and pre-existing conditions, and the cost will be based on their income.
No,
so it's a huge step forward. It's not ideal, but it's a huge step forward, and to not understand what this is going to mean in terms of the lives that are saved and the access to health care would be a mistake.
Can you explain the issue over Medicaid? The Act requires that states expand their Medicaid rolls for poor Americans. But the Supreme Court said that the federal government cannot withhold funds to states who fail to do that expansion. So what does that mean for this Medicaid expansion?
Right. So basically, right now, the federal government pays between a half and some states two-thirds or more of Medicaid. But the states have a lot of leeway other than covering children and pregnant women, who they're going to cover. The new law will say that states will get federal dollars to cover all adults up to one and a third times the poverty level, which is, you know, quite a few uninsured adults fall in that category. And the federal government will pay 100% of that cost for the first 3 years and ratchet it down, but after 10 years, it'll still be 90%. So what the court said is states decide not to do that, they won't be in jeopardy of losing the current Medicaid funds. But it wouldn't make any sense for states to turn that down. If they're accepting federal government funds now where the federal government only pays a half or two-thirds of health of the cost of Medicaid, why would they turn it down when the federal government's paying between 100% to 90% of it? And plus it'll be provide coverage for hundreds of thousands, or in states like California, more than a million people without health care coverage now.
Hmm. Richard Kirsch, could the court have ruled on various aspects of the act that were being challenged, or was it an all-or-nothing decision?
Well, they could have ruled on various aspects, and so you saw that in the decision where they tweaked the ability for the federal government to require states to do the Medicaid expansion. One of the extraordinary things about the four conservative justices, who fortunately Roberts didn't join, is they're willing to throw out the entire law the most ridiculous overreach. The precedence in this is that Congress is supposed to be the court is supposed to be very limited in what it does in deferring to Congress and only overturn parts of a law that's unconstitutional. But the four conservative justices said, well, since we don't think the mandate is constitutional, and who knows if they would have passed the whole law without the mandate, so we're going to throw the whole thing out.
Hmm.
It just shows the extraordinary, vicious partisanship that the four conservative justices still feel. In fact, Justice Kennedy joined them is pretty frightening.
Right.
But, you know, ironically here, Chief Justice Roberts was actually trying to be much more reasonable, and people feel that's one reason is because the entire credibility of the court is online, that if he had gone along with the conservative justices and thrown the law out, that there would be absolutely no credibility for the court anymore. It's shrinking as it is, would be seen as a purely partisan institution. And he's, as the Chief Justice, who's only 57 years old, is cognizant of not wanting to preside over that kind of Supreme Court.
Finally, Richard Kirsch, how does this decision play into this year's presidential elections? It's interesting to see Mitt Romney's position, who presided over, governed a state that had a law healthcare law upon which the Affordable Care Act was based. He was for, quote, Obamacare before he was against it. And of course, President Obama sees the decision as a big victory. But what ripple effect could this decision have in November?
Well, I think in terms of the public, it's likely to help because, you know,
help Obama.
The accusation that the law is unconstitutional is one that the Republicans have made a lot. And so for some people who don't have an opinion about the law, it's likely to help. But the fact is that the final verdict for this law is not going to be what the court ruled yesterday. It's going to be what the American people do on November 6th. And as you say, it's just totally ironic that Romney would be saying his first thing he's going to do is repeal Obamacare, which, of course, he can't actually on himself. But when he is, in many ways, one of the fathers of Obamacare, because Romney Care, as you say, is so much the same. And, you know, the president should have fun with this. He can say to Governor Romney, you know, you should be proud of Romney Care. 95% or more of people in Massachusetts are covered, including virtually every child, 99.5% of kids. Healthcare costs are going down. More businesses are providing coverage, and people love it. And the other thing you can say is, you know, that there's only one state in the country right now where if you lose your job, you don't have to worry about losing your health care, or if you take a job, you still be able to get health care, and that state's Massachusetts. And Mitt, if you get elected to president, Massachusetts is still going to be the only state in the country because you're going to deny that health security to everybody in the country.
Well, Richard Kirsch, you're going to be here in Southern California on July 10th discussing your new book, Fighting for Our Health, at the California Endowment at 1000 North Alameda from 4 to 6 p.m. The name of the book is Fighting for Our Health, The Epic Battle to Make Healthcare a Right in the United States. Richard Kirsch, I want to wish you the best of luck. Thanks so much for joining us.
So thank you so much for taking the time, Sonali.
Richard Kirsch is also the national campaign manager of the Healthcare for America Now Coalition. Well, all of the perspectives on the left side of the spectrum aren't unified on the Supreme Court decision. There are alternative perspectives to the Affordable Care Act. My next guest, Russell McIver, represents that different perspective. He's the founder of Single Payer Action. He's also the editor of the Corporate Crime Reporter. Russell McIver and 50 doctors filed a brief with the Supreme Court asking them to strike down the individual mandate that, quote, forces people to buy lousy private health insurance. We reject Obamacare and Romney Care. Russell McIver now joins me on the phone. Welcome to Uprising.
Good morning.
Good morning, and thanks so much for joining us. What was your reaction yesterday? I think the assumption in the mainstream is that if you're a progressive, you wanted the Supreme Court to uphold the at least the individual mandate aspect of the bill, if not the whole bill.
Right, and we were facing that up on the steps of the Supreme Court yesterday, where you had the corporate Democrats arguing for this bill to be upheld, and you had the corporate Republicans arguing that it be struck down. Of course, this law was written by the insurance companies in the pharmaceutical industry because it protects them. Hmm. And so we were disappointed. We had filed a brief calling on the Supreme Court to strike down the individual mandate. As Dr. Marcia Angel, who's the former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, puts it, the only way that you're going to cover everyone, control costs, and save lives is by getting rid of the health insurance companies, the private health insurance companies, and having, instead of all those hundreds of payers, having just one Medicare for all payer, and you save $400 billion a year, and you won't have 120 Americans dying every day from lack of health insurance. So we were disappointed with the ruling because it keeps in place the private health insurance corporations, and we want to get rid of them.
Now, if the court had struck down the individual mandate, what would you have foreseen? Could that have actually been a good thing for people who want single-payer health care?
Yes, because it would have immediately then we would have been forced into phase two, where we would have a new battle. And the Progressive Caucus had announced that if the mandate would struck down, they would push immediately for a single payer. Now it's another 5 to 10 years of human suffering.
I just want to reiterate that you're saying the Progressive Caucus said that if the mandate had been struck down, they would have all pushed immediately for single payer.
Yes. Now, there are 90 members of the House who have signed on to a single payer bill. So there is support in the House of Representatives for single payer, although they don't fight for it. They've technically signed on to it, and that's the Progressive Caucus.
And just to reiterate for listeners, essentially single payer, another way of looking at it is Medicare for all.
Medicare for all. You get rid of all the private health insurance corporations. You have one payer, and you save $400 billion a year in administrative costs.
Russell, what about the fact that the Affordable Care Act does, for example, disallow the health insurance companies from discriminating against people because of pre-existing health conditions, also against women who are in many cases charged more? I mean, essentially, it sounds as though the Affordable Care Act tries to make private health insurance a little less unfair, a little a little more fair. Is that a good way of putting it? And the
health insurance companies and the pharmaceutical industry are willing to accept those baby steps because they know that the ultimate solution, which we will get to someday, because the suffering is too great without it. And the financial disaster that this kind of system inflicts on our country is too great without it. They know that someday we're going to get to single payer, the way Taiwan has, the way Canada has, the way the United Kingdom has, the way most of Europe has, the way the vast majority of Western industrialized countries have. They know someday they're going to get there and that they're going to be out of business where their profits are going to be, in the pharmaceutical industry's case, severely curtailed. So they know someday we're going to get there. They just want, they want it to be later, not sooner. We want it to be sooner, not later.
No.
Because the American people are suffering. I mean, there are people between the vast majority of the people who die from lack of health insurance are between the ages of 55 and 65. And there are people, we know, personally know people, everybody does, who are putting on hold operations and going to see the health care provider because they have no insurance.
And yet the president...
If they die as a result, that's because of this system that we've set up.
The president, in his victory speech, if you will, yesterday, excoriated people who can afford to buy health insurance but don't. I mean, sort of lecturing them that those who can afford to do it but don't raise the cost for everybody else. I personally don't think I know anybody who can actually afford to buy health insurance but choose not to.
I don't know who he's talking about. There might be like some weird minority in the country. But my case, for example, I'm self-employed. I have a wife and two kids. I'm paying $8,000 a year for really crappy coverage. I mean, my deductible is $15,000. That means my insurance company pays nothing until I pay $15,000 a year. And so it's just catastrophic insurance. So there's 50 million Americans who are uninsured. There's another, a huge number who are what I call underinsured. That's my category. And I as a family, we're ready to say, hey, we can't afford this.
Nancy Pelosi joined President Obama also in that same vein, blaming young people yesterday for not buying insurance. I mean, maybe she doesn't realize the epidemic of joblessness among young people today. She called them free riders. Now, the president also talked about reining in controls and said that insurance companies wouldn't be able to increase the cost of premiums unless they were able to justify them. And is that an out? Because, I mean, essentially, can't the insurance companies use anything to justify premium rises?
Well, you know, my premiums go up about 30% a year. And so I'm not feeling any impact. I live in West Virginia. I complained to the West Virginia Insurance Commissioner, and they said there's nothing we can do. There probably are some baby steps that should be preserved in this law. But again, in terms of a structural deficiency, this law has to be defeated. We should repeal it and move on to single payer, because this is to give an indication of how this came about. This bill clearly was a deal cut between the pharmaceutical industry, the insurance companies, and both political parties, and the Supreme Court sided with the corporations yesterday. This was a deal to protect the corporations, because they know that the answer that the American people want is the death penalty for the insurance industry.
And so essentially the rest is just political theater then. Finally, Russell McIver, what about the opening for states in their effort to create the sort of insurance marketplace that President Obama was talking about? Is there an opening for states like California, for example, to use the Affordable Care Act to start a type of single-payer healthcare state by state?
It can't be a type of single payer. I mean, people are touting Vermont as single payer. Vermont is not single payer. Mm-hmm. There are multiple payers. There's Medicare, there's Medicaid, there's, you know, private health companies that are going to run the system. So, you know, it's not single payer. And you need everybody in one. This is the, you know, actuary 101. You need everybody in one pool to give you the power to negotiate with the pharmaceutical industries to keep costs down and to stabilize the system. Unfortunately, we have two corporate parties. We reject Obamacare. We reject Romney Care. We reject both corporate parties. And we have to be real with ourselves. We have to start anew and challenge these corporate parties. People like Richard Kurtz, they're all corporate Democrats or corporate front people. They support this insurance industry written bill. We have to reject all of that, start new, and realize what great countries like Taiwan and Canada and the UK realized long ago, that this is the only way. The amazing thing being in front of the Supreme Court yesterday was the astonishment of the foreign press that we're still accepting the crumbs that the insurance industry gives us. They're just totally out of their mind. They can't believe that we haven't come to the realization that we have to get rid of them.
Well, Russell McIver, it's always a pleasure to have you on. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Russell McIver is founder of Single Payer Action. He's also the editor of the Corporate Crime Reporter. This is Uprising. We've been discussing the Supreme Court's upholding of the Affordable Care Act yesterday. And after this short break, we will turn to Mexico, which is gearing up for highly anticipated presidential elections on Sunday. We'll also hear this week's Rethink Reviews. And then a major protest is planned this weekend for the Walmart invasion coming to a neighborhood near you. Stay tuned.
Tycho Project returns to the Ford Amphitheater for a one-night-only Tycho Drumming Spectacular on Saturday, June 30th at 8 p.m. The concert features Tycho Project, America's leading professional Tycho drum ensemble, along with their sister groups Kitsune Tycho, Loma Pacific Tycho, and Tanuki Tycho. Traditional Tycho songs remixed with a contemporary edge will fill the hills of Hollywood with some of the biggest drum sounds in Southern California. More details at kpfk.org. Ticket information available through the Ford box office at 323-461-3673. That's 323-GO-1-FORD. KPFK is a proud media sponsor.
Organized by Ciceret, based in Long Beach, California. More about them online at ReverbNation.com/Ciceret, S-I-S-A-R-E-T. Or check the featured music section of UprisingRadio.org later today. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. Armed men kidnapped Marisol Mora Cuevas from her home in Mexico on Sunday, just a week before national elections. Cuevas is the mayor of a city in the eastern Mexican state of Veracruz and the second mayor of the city to be disappeared. In the run-up to next Sunday's elections, candidates running for various offices throughout the country have reported being intimidated and threatened. Meanwhile, the special prosecutor for electoral crimes care has received hundreds of complaints of election offenses, including voter bribery, as election day nears. On Monday, in the busy Mexico City International Airport, three policemen were shot and killed by two federal state officers suspected of working for drug traffickers. In the contentious race for president, however, the harassment and violence has reportedly been avoided as a major topic of concern in campaign speeches. Enrique Peña Nieto, candidate with the Institutional Revolutionary Party, or PRI, continues to be pegged as the frontrunner in polls, followed by Andrés Manuel López Obrador, running for the presidency a second time with the left-leaning Party of the Democratic Revolution, or PRD. Obrador lost his 2006 bid for the office to current President Felipe Calderón by less than 1% of the vote, a result that he and his supporters view as manufactured and illegitimate. This time around, Obrador has pledged to be a unifying force if elected, proposing a cabinet that includes members outside of his own party. The populist Yo Soy 132 movement has not officially aligned with any candidate, instead turning out hundreds of thousands of protesters during multiple demonstrations to oppose a return of the PRI to power, which held the presidency for nearly 80 years before the PAN captured the office in 2000. Yo Soy 132 also called international attention to allegations that Televisa, the largest Spanish-language broadcasting network, sold airtime for candidates and gave disproportionately favorable coverage to Nieto during the 2009 midterm elections. The Guardian this month substantiated their claims and this week broke news that Televisa ran a unit codenamed Team Hancock, dedicated to enhancing Nieto's image. My guest is Ruben Tapia. He is a producer of Enfoque Latino here on KPFK, the longest-running Spanish-language news magazine show in Los Angeles. Welcome to Uprising, Ruben.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, you're preparing to actually go to Mexico for the elections, and I want to announce that KPFK is going to have 8 hours of special programming covering the elections on Sunday, and we'll give details about that a little later in the program. Ruben, how is the mood in Mexico right now, as well as here in the U.S. among Mexican nationals who are gearing up to vote? Does this election seem to be more important than past elections?
Well, you know, very, very important, this election, and the mood. It is like in two different levels, in my opinion. First, there's a lot of enthusiasm because, you know, the Jewish movement started more than a month ago to energize the political campaigns because they start to see that what you were reporting, you know, there's no fairness in the way that main Mexican media, particularly the electronic media, cover the different candidates. Actually, there's been allegations of strict operations to favor the pre-candidate. But, you know, I want to tell you that right now in La Jornada appear this figure. Seven of every three Mexicans believe that it's possibility of a fraud this coming Sunday.
Three out of seven Mexicans believe that?
Seven out of ten. 71% is what they are saying. Now, in the meantime, you know, the left coalition that is proposing López Obrador accused the PRI of having 1,800,000 debit cards from a big store, La Soriana, you know, in order to bribe the votes, you know, the people to buy the voting, you know.
So over a million debit cards from a major store to exchange for people in exchange for their voting cards?
That's correct. Hmm. You know, so that's the situation 2 days before, you know, the election. So there is at the meantime, the violence is being, you know, a constant. Right now, you were mentioning Marisol Mora Cuevas, which was kidnapped yesterday, was found dead. You know, so it's part of this at least five politicians that have been killed during these 3 months of political campaign in Mexico.
Now, what exactly is the voter participation expected to be in Mexico? I mean, despite the dangers, I understand that there's expected to be very high voter turnout.
Well, there's different. Yesterday we interviewed Jorge Alberto López Gallardo, which is a mathematical, a scientific from the University of Texas in El Paso. He wrote a book about the electoral fraud in 2006. and is projecting that it's going to happen again, because he did an analysis about all the way that this computer voter counting is acting, and is saying that the possibilities are high, and expect that there's going to be at least around 50% or maybe less of voting participation. Yesterday too, I interviewed another Mexican analyst, Samuel Smith, and it's kind of along those lines. But when I interview people from the Obrador campaign, if you see what happened in Mexico City last Wednesday, more than a million people, gathered in this Zócalo to say that they're going to be participating, and then they say that they are securing that 400,000 people is going to be covering all these 140,000 voting places, which is going to be setting for the Mexican elections coming Sunday.
What about the polls? It seems as though a lot of polls, most polls, if not all of them, are showing that Enrique Peña Nieto is leading. I'm wondering what you think about the veracity of these polls. Andrés Manuel López Obrador seems to still be trailing Nieto by at least a few percentage points, if not more. Do you trust these polls?
No, not at all. The thing is, actually this scientist was telling me yesterday that, for example, one company was having a daily polling, and it was demonstrating that it is not possible, in order to have a credibility on this polling in a daily basis, how they are just more than 60%, they just interview like more than 1,000 people in a constant number. So they are not, these polls are not really representative of what really happening in Mexico. There are pollings that are, people that pay the polling, they are, is by order, I would say.
Now, given the level of skepticism that you mentioned, 7 out of 10 Mexicans expecting there to be voter fraud, the revelations that the media has been colluding to give some candidates more favorable coverage, it is surprising that there will still be a high voter turnout. What do you make of voter faith in the process? Is there just this high level of participation and the hope that if enough people participate, the election may actually be fair, or are people just, I'm just surprised that people are still going to participate given how much they expect for their vote to not be counted?
Yeah, but I think, it's a big question for me, that I'm going to be traveling with people from Los Angeles. We're going to be traveling to Tijuana, because the Mexicans that were not able to have the mail-in voting, which was a very low, less than around 50,000 people, we were again this mailing the way that they can vote through mail. Like the last figures, just 30,000 in the whole country just send their mail-in voting. But the rest that we are not able to, we're gonna have to travel myself to Tijuana. It's gonna be some people from us. Some indigenous organization is putting together
And you're talking about Mexican nationals in the U.S. who are eligible to vote are going to be traveling to Tijuana to cast their votes?
Yes, or people that have double nationality that they can vote.
Dual citizenship, vote. Yeah.
Yeah, the citizenship. So we are going to be covering this. But, there's a lot of campaigns we are not seeing yet, because a lot of people is been doing the social media. So Mexicans through the history, they have been, one of the characteristics is we, don't say much, but at the end we decide to say that's it. And then might be the case this coming Sunday, because what's happening in Mexico is really serious. I'm going to tell you just in Juarez, Chihuahua, there's more than 200,000 people from Juarez now living in El Paso. Mm. with no documents because the violence in Ciudad Juarez was still happening. More than 60,000 people have been killed. Out of every 10 killings are being investigated, only one.
And also drug-related murders in the past 5 years have been estimated at tens of thousands. The World Bank has estimated a 50% national poverty rate in Mexico. So the stakes are very, very high.
Absolutely. So we are in a state of emergency, actually, which is not being portrayed in the media. The media, you know, and everything just looks like everything is okay. There's a political parties like a very fair contest, and then Mexico is going, okay, they have problems like everyone, but now the figures, the general macro figures, is Mexican economy has been growing a little bit, but now it's going to be, after the election, it's going to be everything okay, kind of like a Disneyland fantasy, while in the reality, you know, a lot of people is suffering and a lot of people is in fear about the violence, but it's not been stopping, it's still increasing, and there's no hope that it's going to be getting better.
Finally, Ruben, what about Andrés Manuel López Obrador's candidacy? I'd like for you to comment very briefly on whether you think if he does have a good chance of winning, and if there isn't voter fraud and he does win, he could represent a new chapter for Mexico.
You know, I have hopes that he can win, but the key part is if the Mexicans go to the polls in a massive way. You know, this scientist that I interview, López Gallardo, says that at least there has to be like 80% of all the people, which is estimated 80 million people are registered. You know, so there has to be like 80% outcome in order to prevent any fraud. Because, you know, Federal Institute, which is going to be counting the votes, they say that there's no chance to a fraud. But the last, one of the last information that they say is now you can, it's going to be like for a pencil, it's going to be marked instead of a particular marker that we're using before. The last minute, they say, no, now it's going to be a pencil because this marker might have a problem. So we don't know exactly what kind of pencil special they're going to be using now. And this is the last minute announcement that I was saying.
Well, Ruben, we will certainly follow this story and be covering it on Monday. I want to wish you the best of luck and thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Ruben Tapia is the producer of Enfoque Latino, longest-running Spanish-language news magazine in Los Angeles. And on Sunday, July 1st, on the day of the elections, KPFK is going to have 8 hours of special programming covering the elections. There will be a two-hour special from noon to 2 p.m., produced and coordinated by some of KPFK's Spanish-language programmers, including Ruben. And then our coverage will pick up again at 6 p.m. when polls close across Mexico. There will be 3 hours produced by the Contragolpe team, which will also be reporting from Mexico City and anchored from KPFK studios by a team that includes Ernesto Arce from our news department here. And then at 9 p.m., three more hours of coverage of the historic elections by the same team that brought you the earlier coverage. So there's going to be 8 hours of coverage, noon to 2 p.m., and then 6 p.m. to midnight on Sunday. This is Uprising. Up next, this week's Rethink Reviews.
I'm Jonathan Kim, and this is Rethink Reviews, where we take a deeper look at current and past films and how they relate to the world today.
I am Merida, firstborn descendant of Clan Dunbrog, and I'll be shooting for my own hand.
What are you doing?
With an unprecedented track record of critically acclaimed and box office smashing films that have delighted and amazed both kids and adults, it seems that animation studio Pixar has become their own stiffest competition, with each new film deemed a disappointment if it doesn't match or exceed the latest high watermark they've set. But their latest film, Brave, has a unique set of pressures, as not only the first film in Pixar's 18-year history with a female main character, and Pixar's first entry into Disney's profitable princesses merchandising behemoth, but it's also the first Pixar film directed by a woman, Brenda Chapman, who came up with the story but was replaced partway through production. Brave takes place in medieval Scotland, where a teenage princess with an unruly tangle of bright red hair named Merida, voiced by Kelly MacDonald, is beginning to bristle at her royal obligations. While Merida would rather spend her days with her bow and arrow exploring the Scottish wilds, her mother, Eleanor, voiced by Emma Thompson, wants Merida to buckle down, act more ladylike, and fulfill her royal duties. However, these duties include Merida being married off to the son of one of three clan chieftains to maintain order in the kingdom. For Merida, this is the last straw, and she responds first by embarrassing both her family and the clans, then by having a spell cast on her mom that promises to change Eleanor's mind about Merida's fate. But when the spell is more than Merida bargained for, she must find a way to reverse it and prevent the kingdom from descending into tribal warfare. At one point, Merida says that, quote, legends are lessons. And one of the most striking things about Brave is how much it feels like it could be an ancient myth, despite being an original story. As with all Pixar films, a beautifully rendered world is a given, and the artists at Pixar have outdone themselves again with the stunning and endlessly detailed Scotland they've created, with Merida's wild mane as the crowning achievement. One thing I've always admired about Pixar movies are their somewhat unconventional messages for kids, which go beyond tired bromides like believe in yourself and beauty is on the inside, to explore themes like jealousy and the fear of obsolescence in the Toy Story trilogy, the plight of the truly different in The Incredibles, and the idea that love means letting go and finding Nemo. The message in Brave is again an unconventional one, but with a bit of a twist. A lesser studio would have been content with Brave's obvious message that kids should have the freedom to be who they want to be. But by making Eleanor a bigger character, Merida learns that while she should be true to herself, that's not an excuse to be selfish. And to avoid trouble, parents and kids need to really listen to each other. It's a nuanced idea with no simple answers, and it's a gutsy thing to hang a kid's film on that could start some interesting conversations. Brave is good, but it ranks pretty low compared to Pixar's many classics. A big reason is that Brave is about humans in a historical setting, so there isn't the same cleverness and humor in seeing the world through the eyes of fish, toys, or monsters. And for longtime Pixar fans, it's hard not to be unsettled by the fact that Brave, following Cars 2, is Pixar's second film in a row where merchandising seems to have trumped heart. Still, a mediocre Pixar film is often better than a good film by anyone else. And while I'll be curious to see if boys are able to get into a story about mothers and daughters, I think Brave has some interesting stuff that's worth a trip to the theater. Brave is rated PG and is in theaters now. I'm Jonathan Kim, and this is a Rethink review for Uprising.
Thanks, Jonathan. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. Dancing dragons and Chinese good luck offerings marked the start of construction of Walmart's Chinatown grocery store on Tuesday over the protests of many in the community. Walmart hosted a press conference inside the empty 33,000 square foot space soon to be turned into a Walmart Chinatown grocery store on Cesar Chavez and Grand Avenues. The store construction has drawn strong opposition from advocacy groups and labor unions that fear Walmart's presence will stifle local businesses and litter the community with low-wage, part-time jobs with inadequate health benefits. For activists, the struggle to stop Walmart Chinatown is an important step in fighting the multinational's recent targeting of Los Angeles for its next urban grocery market boom. The Los Angeles Alliance for a New Economy, or LANE, which has been fighting the opening of Walmart Chinatown since its announcement earlier this year, found that Walmart aims to grab 21% of the grocery market in L.A. This would mean the opening of 212 new Walmart stores in the area, resulting in an estimated loss of 8,744 retail jobs, $621 million in annual lost wages, and an increase of 9,400 employees using Medi-Cal. A 2004 LA City ordinance putting restrictions on large chain stores has prevented Walmart from establishing itself in Los Angeles up until recently, when Walmart skirted the regulation by getting permits to build smaller stores under the 100,000 square foot limit. Local activists appealed the decision to let Walmart build in Chinatown and have organized a massive protest and march on Saturday, June 30th, at 1245 North Spring Street. A coalition of organizations, including the LA County Federation of Labor and the Koreatown community, as well as local businesses, will participate in the expected 10,000-person protest to make it the largest anti-Walmart protest in U.S. history. My guest is Carolyn O'Connor. She's the communications director with the Los Angeles County Federation of Labor. Welcome to Uprising, Carolyn.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. How do you come up with the numbers that I mentioned earlier, that if Walmart were to get into Los Angeles, thousands of jobs would be lost, millions in annual wages would be lost, and that the number of employees using Medi-Cal would increase. Where did those numbers come from?
Well, this, those numbers came from a study based out of New York City by a group called Walmart Free NYC. And Walmart has a similar, they have a new aggressive growth strategy for urban markets in the United States. They've really maxed out in rural and suburban America, and the one place that they have yet to really infiltrate and grow is are the urban centers. And so you have, you know, Walmart trying to get into New York City, Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, San Francisco, Chicago. And so the numbers that we came up with Los Angeles was based on a study out of New York City using the same methodology, which is that Walmart currently has a national average of 21% of the grocery industry, the grocery markets. And so that varies, right, depending on where you are with, you know, if you're in a rural area, it could be 100%. Walmart's your only option, the only game in town. For some communities. In other communities, like in Los Angeles, it's less so. But in order for Walmart to grow and continue to make the kinds of profits that its shareholders are demanding of it, it's looking to urban markets to grow. And so those numbers come from their national average market share. And if they were to achieve that in Los Angeles, what that would mean would be opening 212 Walmart stores in Los Angeles County.
Is it known that Walmart is going to be coming into certain areas? I mean, certainly, obviously, the Chinatown store is now official, but
right.
We've also heard Altadena
That's right. And that's, I mean, our major concern right now in Los Angeles is that we have a lot of concerns about Walmart, right? And Walmart has a track record of net job losses when they move into a community. Walmart has a track record of driving down wages for people who who are able to keep their job in retail, but because of the Walmart low wages, they have an impact on driving down wages for everyone else. They have a track record of shuttering small local businesses.
So aside from the Chinatown and Altadena plans, is it known what other areas in L.A. County the store plans to open branches?
Well, we know that Burbank is an area that they're looking at. We know that Panorama City. And these have all just started cropping up within the last year. And, for instance, Altadena was just about a week ago. So Walmart has come into Los Angeles. They've been looking around at several locations. They're going to permitting agencies, and so it's just a matter of us making sure that our elected officials and city and county officials are being transparent, and that Walmart's being transparent as they're rooting around Los Angeles looking for locations to open, because they do have this new model, right? They're not coming into Los Angeles to build these big box stores. They can't do that. We were able to keep them out on that. What they have is this new kind of boutique, quote-unquote, neighborhood markets, small-scale Walmarts. But it's the same old Walmart. It's just repackaged.
Now, I understand the Los Angeles City Council earlier this year in March had attempted to did draft a law temporarily banning big grocery, big chain stores from opening. And it passed 13-0, but it was found right before that vote that Walmart had obtained the permits that it needed just a day earlier.
That's right. Less than 24 hours before a major vote by the LA City Council, which did unanimously, would have stopped Walmart from opening in Chinatown, Walmart received permits from the city. And we have concern with that. Several Chinese American groups in Chinatown have filed an appeal process, an appeal on those permits. And so there's going
to try to revoke them
in August, excuse me?
To try to revoke those permits that it got.
Correct.
Hmm. Oh, does that vote, the 13-0 vote, impact any other Walmart store plans in other parts of L.A. County? Or, well, I guess it would just have to be L.A. City, right?
Correct. That is L.A. City.
Hmm. So that would only apply to any new Walmart stores in the city?
Well, that specifically, that vote was taken on Chinatown. And so
I see. So it was a very specific vote.
Correct.
It's certainly the existing ban on stores over 100,000 square feet has prevented Walmart from opening the big box stores. But 33,000 square feet, which is a Chinatown store, still sounds pretty big.
Sure, it is. I mean, it's a large scale grocery store. And it is.
So it's not a department store like the big box stores.
Correct.
It's just groceries.
It's just groceries.
And breaking into the grocery market, I suppose, is considered quite lucrative. But it also addresses a lot of food issues. I mean, here in Los Angeles, there's a growing movement of people who are trying to increase availability of locally grown organic foods. The food movement is quite strong. What would Walmart coming in with hundreds of grocery stores in this part of the country, how would it impact that movement?
I think it impacts everybody, no matter what movement you're in. I think the way that Walmart impacts all of us, food movement, civil rights movement, labor movement, people of faith and other movements, we're all impacted by Walmart because of their outsized influence on our economy. And so whether or not we're able to be able to afford to purchase fresh food is based on whether or not we have the types of incomes in order to be able to afford those fresh foods. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the huge concern everyone should have first and foremost with Walmart is that we all need to have wages that we can afford to buy our own food and to pay, to have medical health insurance that we don't have to rely on government public assistance while we're working full time. I mean, that's what the issue with Walmart is that they're the number one private employer in this nation, 1.4 million Walmart associates making poverty-level wages and driving down the wages for the rest of us.
So, of course, for labor, it's a huge, huge issue. Tell us about the protest that's happening tomorrow. It's expected to draw 10,000 people.
Yeah, it's going to be exciting. We want to call out everybody to come to this protest in Chinatown. It's going to be the largest Walmart protest ever held in this country. It's going to be very Los Angeles, a very diverse crowd from the Chinatown line dancers to the Teamsters Motorcycle Club to community church, faith communities, workers, civil rights groups, women's rights groups. It's going to be families, kids. Tom Morello is going to be playing. And there's going to be another show tonight, a benefit show in Chinatown. So hopefully we'll have a lot of music fans there. I mean, it's going to be a really, really diverse, exciting event, and we just hope that everybody comes out to Chinatown 10 a.m. tomorrow. We're meeting at the L.A. State Historic Park, otherwise known as the Cornfield, and we'll be marching through the streets of Chinatown. We'll have a rally under the dragons, the official kind of entrance into Chinatown will be a big rally. We'll have Presidential Medal of Freedom recipient Dolores Huerta speaking. Like I said, Tom Morello will be playing. U.S. Congresswoman Judy Chu is going to be there. She's pledged not to take Walmart money. And in another bit of exciting news, three of the mayoral candidates in Los Angeles just came out yesterday. Eric Garcetti, Wendy Gruhl, and Jan Perry saying they will not take Walmart money. And that's an exciting thing because we need to make sure that we keep their money out of the political process here in Los Angeles.
So that's happening tomorrow at 10 a.m. at Los Angeles. Starts at Los Angeles Historic State Park, 1245 North Spring Street, and goes into Chinatown. Now, aside from a major protest like this, which certainly has the effect of being able to rally the community, what other very concrete way is there to stop the construction of the Chinatown Walmart? The construction has officially begun this past Tuesday. Is the legal effort to revoke the permits retroactively based on the city council vote the only avenue right now, or is there are there plans for some kind of a lawsuit or legal challenge?
A legal challenge is definitely a possibility. It hasn't moved forward yet. There actually is still a step or two before they could begin building in that store, and this appeal is going to hold that off. So we do have a plan right now. This appeal is going to allow for a public hearing. It's going to allow for the Chinatown community to come out and have their voices heard. I mean, this is all done in a very shady way. The day before a major vote, we have not had any public input on this.
Which agency's hands does it lie to decide to revoke the permit?
I believe it's the CRA, but I can double check on that and get back with you.
Is there a way then? Will there be a way for people to find out tomorrow how they can affect that process and how they can get involved? Are there local groups that are also organizing preparing for essentially what is a Walmart invasion into LA?
We are preparing to stop a Walmart invasion in LA, and that is why people need to come tomorrow. to the rally, and we will have information there about how to, you know, how to stay in touch. We're going to have a, you know, a large group of folks there. We're going to make sure people are connected and will continue to be connected in this fight. And so we hope that, that people come tomorrow. And we will continue to promote this on, you know, online and social media. People can join on Facebook, the at the LA County Federation of Labor Facebook page. We have an event. People can go on there, sign up for tomorrow, and we'll continue to keep people updated on where this fight goes.
We will find that Facebook link and post it to uprisingradio.org later today.
Can I tell you one more link?
Absolutely.
LALabor.tumblr.com has all the information for tomorrow. LALabor.tumblr.com. It has the directions, the map, the route, flyers, and other information for anyone that wants to come.
That's lalabor.tumblr.com. Carolyn O'Connor, best of luck to you. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Carolyn O'Connor is the communications director of the Los Angeles County Federation of Labor. Again, the march is taking place tomorrow, Saturday, June 30th at 10 a.m., starting at the Cornfield. That's the Los Angeles Historic State Park, 1245 North Spring Street. And lalabor.tumblr.com has all the information. If you missed it, go to uprisingradio.org later today. This is Uprising, and for Sonali's subversive thought for the day, Samuel Adams once said, "It does not take a majority to prevail, but rather an irate, tireless minority keen on setting brush fires of freedom in the minds of men and women." That's Samuel Adams, and that's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. By the way, thank you to everybody who showed up at the fantastic Chris Hedges event last night. Turnout was amazing. There were maybe more than 1,000 of you, and we were so pleased to see you. So thank you so much for supporting KPFK. We hope you enjoyed the event. You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our assistant producer. Leonardo Alanis is our intern. Chris Bennett is our music curator. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. Visit us online at uprisingradio.org, where you can listen to all of our interviews, rate them, leave comments, share them on Facebook and Twitter, and find links and events we mention on the air. Send your story ideas to mail at uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. Have a wonderful weekend. I'll see you Monday at 8.